from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll speak with Milwaukee City Attorney Evan Goyke about his goals for the office and how he hopes to improve the city. Then we'll learn why leaves change color in fall.
As the plants sense that the days are getting shorter and the temperature is going down, particularly at night, the plants start getting ready for winter.
Plus, we'll get a preview of the upcoming Milwaukee Muslim Film Festival at the Oriental Theater.
For now going on 9 years, every single film has a talk back or a panel or some component, because we feel that that's really part of the experience, to have that dialogue, to have that discussion.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Milwaukee's city attorney often operates in the background of some of the biggest issues facing the city. In recent months, the office has handled legal questions for protests and security at the Republican National Convention, provided advice when it was revealed MPS hadn't completed necessary financial reporting, as well as when the Housing Authority was accused of mismanagement. Evan Goyke was elected city attorney in the spring and is the subject of a profile in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. Lake Effect's Sam Woods speaks with Goyke about progress made on his campaign goals and how his office works behind the scenes.
When I interview you ahead of the city attorney election last spring, you mentioned that your top priorities included returning the city attorney's office to a, quote, world-class law firm, end quote, housing and public safety. And I want to start by checking in on the progress of those goals. So first off, the city attorney's office being a, quote, world-class law firm. Can you explain what this means and the steps you've taken to accomplish it?
Yeah, so that was something that I said repeatedly through the campaign, throughout the campaign. And what I really meant was our first priority was filling vacancies. That the office had been plagued under the previous administration with high turnover. And when I started, there were a number of vacancies. What that does is, you know, displaces more work onto other shoulders. And then we had a number of lawyers overworked or overburdened. They were doing their assignment plus the assignment of the vacant position, or we were farming assignments outside of our office that we couldn't handle. We are 5 months later, and I am able to say that we are, again, fully staffed to our capacity. We've hired to fill all those vacancies. And I really put a priority on trying to return previous lawyers that had previously worked in the office so that, you know, as we're bringing and filling in those positions, we're bringing back experienced people that were ready to go on day one. I think the number of 7 lawyers of the 8 that I've hired or 7 of the 9 that I've hired have come back, something like that. But a priority of recruiting folks that could be ready on day one. And what that has done and what I feel on a daily basis in the halls of the office has really not only just filled the gaps that were there, but has really rebuilt a lot of the confidence, and there's a lot more camaraderie, and you hear and feel a lot more collaboration, one lawyer walking a file down the hallway and having an experienced lawyer to go to ask a question. We're always better when you're bouncing ideas off of one another. You know, I'm confident in saying we're back to that world-class status. I think we have a lot of work ahead of us to, you know, reach our full potential, but I'm very proud of the progress we've made in 5 months.
Also, in our interview last spring, you mentioned that housing quality was a priority of your office, or would be if you were elected. And specifically, you mentioned holding landlords accountable for providing quality housing, given that renters are paying 30% or more of their income for it. But what does this look like day to day? Like, how exactly does your office accomplish this?
So we are actually just this week had one of the positions that we recently filled, an attorney that's going to be assigned to this role. We title that role nuisance abatement. So it's often complaints that generate from neighbors or from members of the city council or through the police department or the Department of Neighborhood Services. and we prosecute municipal violations of the building code. We've recently had some meetings about how we can more effectively collect the debts that are owed. We got a report generated internally of the I'm going to call them the top 100 offenders of property owners that have been cited for building code violations. And the average, we're talking tens of thousands of dollars owed, dozens and dozens of convictions in municipal court. We have to hold those individuals accountable, both in collecting the debts that are owed to the city, as well as ensuring compliance that those work orders are actually being addressed and fixed. We are rebuilding that team. I wish I could give you a more firm announcement of what that's going to look like, or that we were initiating really large, complex lawsuits against some of the largest offenders. But we are working towards rebuilding that type of litigation where we can really go after individuals and hold them accountable. But what we're doing internally, rebuilding the staff, it's a positions that have been largely vacant for the last couple of years. And then working with our partners in the police department, in, you know, police districts, neighbors, neighborhood associations, alderpersons, to target those properties that have been a nuisance for the neighborhood for a long time. Kind of our worst offenders list, we're going to address those and then look at how we can build that proactive litigation, you know, moving forward.
How are you planning to measure success when it comes to housing?
That is a great question. I don't have a quantitative answer for you. I don't want a quota of lawsuits.
Right.
You know, I don't want to manufacture litigation just to, you know, meet some promise that I said on the radio. I want to hear it from people, right? I mean, I live on the north side. I'm pretty plugged in. I will be in many of these community meetings myself. So I think the proof is in the pudding. It isn't you file two lawsuits and you feel good about yourself. It's when the conditions are actually improved. There will always be work to do. Individuals, unfortunately, if there's an opportunity for them to take advantage, that kind of has been historically what has played out. But I want the actual conditions in these neighborhoods to improve, and that will be success in my mind.
So turning to public safety, last spring you also emphasized the role you wanted your office to play in public safety, and specifically in combating reckless driving. So I'll start with, what exactly is your office's role in ensuring streets are safe?
So we are the prosecutors. We have five lawyers that staff the three municipal court branches downtown. When a police officer in Milwaukee Police Department or an officer in the Marquette Police Department issues a citation for driving, that is then, you know, forwarded to our prosecutors who actually prosecute those cases. Many of them are resolved through some form of plea bargain or plea negotiation, but they do trials. They actually conduct trials against the defendant who's accused of you know, some traffic offense, speeding, reckless driving, et cetera, all of the above. And in that role, it gives us a view of the system, you know, from the trenches of what is working and what is not working. And, you know, we had an announcement last week regarding a new policy internally of how we'll handle reckless driving citations, which we can get into more detail if you'd like. And that really stems from conversations from our municipal court prosecutors on what would be, you know, what are shortcomings of the way we've been doing it, and what are some options or opportunities to improve that system.
Yeah, I do actually. I want to talk about reckless driving citations, but I'll start in more of a general sense. So when I've gone to meetings about reckless driving, there's usually kind of three camps of solutions. There's enforcement of the law and legal penalties for breaking the law while driving. There's kind of engineering solutions, you know, those bump outs and just making it more difficult to drive recklessly on the streets. And then there's usually some kind of education bucket, like a driver's education in school kind of thing. Is your office, this may be more of a government process question, but is your office only involved in that legal penalty aspect? And then there's other parts of government that we're working on those other solutions? Or
yeah, we are directly involved in the first two that you mentioned. We aren't really involved in the education side. We're heavily involved. We are the prosecutors for municipal courts, so that is directly to us and a responsibility that we have. we work, our attorneys work behind the scenes with the Department of Public Works on contracts and projects. So when you hear announcements of $5 million going to a project to make a certain street safer through bump outs or protected bike lanes or whatever that is, we are involved behind the scenes in making sure that the contract is let on time and is protecting the city's interest and whatever subcontractors. All of those, all of that paper documents are done appropriately, followed through, and go through, you know, the city process correctly. And I mean, just to editorialize, I am a firm believer that all three of those legs are necessary to the stool, right? I mean, it does take each effort. It can't just be enforcement. It can't just be engineering. It can't just be education. It's got to be all of them. And I think you've seen in Milwaukee a pretty consistent response in each of those. Was excited to support at the state level. New driver's ed programs back in MPS schools. That's great. I'm a fan of the traffic calming efforts. That's great. And, you know, we announced last week more of an intentional effort to prosecute reckless driving citations.
So I'm going to ask a similar question to the housing one. It's similar issue in that it can be kind of hard to measure success, right? It's not necessarily, well, we brought more people to court, so therefore we're doing our job. But how are you thinking of success in this realm, reckless driving specifically?
Yeah, it's a similar answer for me. I'm interested in real improvements in the quality of life for the residents of the city. I would measure success not by the number of convictions achieved or citations issued. I don't want to push us to do that. We should issue citations where appropriate. We're going to prosecute them when provable. We should get convictions where we can. That alone isn't the metric that I define success. Again, it's going to be when you're at a community meeting and reckless driving is not a top one, two, or three item in the residents that come forward about what they view as the, you know, biggest improvements needed to their quality of life. Once we see that kind of organic street level call for action and relief dissipate, which I hope we do because the behavior has changed, that's really the measure of success that I'm interested in.
You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Sam Woods in conversation with Milwaukee City Attorney Evan Goyke. So, Evan, perhaps the biggest event in Milwaukee since your term began was the Republican National Convention. And in this month's Milwaukee Magazine interview, you were asked why you were with protesters. And I'm paraphrasing a bit here, but it seems like you explained that your role was essentially as a visible liaison between protesters and law enforcement, kind of explaining the rights of protesters in real time. First off, is that accurate?
Yes, that was one of the roles. Okay. I mean, that was why I felt it was important to have our office represented and to be present. You can't have real-time discussion and negotiation, mediation, compromise, whatever it may be, de-escalation from behind a computer screen or a TV screen. So I thought there was no better place for me and some of my staff to be out there. And it was a very interesting and educational experience. I'm really glad that we made that choice internally and that I was there. We also, you know, the city of Milwaukee was sued and our office handled the litigation in defending the city's action. So some of those same individuals that we were talking to during the first day of the RNC, where there was the most coordinated and largest protest, we were in litigation in federal court, you know, 2 weeks before or 10 days before. So, you know, our role was multifaceted in that we helped. There were dozens upon dozens upon dozens of contracts that were entered into with different states, local law enforcement officers. The procurement to bring and have the materials necessary to execute that convention we were involved with for well more than a year before the actual convention came to town. Litigation, and then the days of, we were out there, you know, every day, and in part, our only role, or the kind of this First Amendment, was really important to us, but it wasn't the only role that we served. We were kind of everywhere. I think it was an interesting week.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's an understatement. But so the protest that you're mentioning on Monday of the RNC, first day of the RNC, went off seemingly without a hitch, peaceful, all that stuff. But then the next day, police officers from Columbus, Ohio, killed Samuel Sharp about a half mile away from the security perimeter. And I bring this up because in the Milwaukee Magazine article, you declined to comment on this incident. Can you explain why you declined to comment?
Yeah, and I can't go into details again, so I have to decline, and that is because it has the potential for litigation, that has the potential to involve me or my office, and in this role, it is not appropriate for me to make public commentary about cases that are either, you know, have the potential to be in a litigation posture or are in a litigation posture. So, you know, it's something that the rules of ethics that govern the practice of law prevent me from going into.
Gotcha. So what I'm hearing is that we should never expect a comment from you on this incident. Or is this something that once the investigation is wrapped up, then you can speak?
I think there's a point in time in which if there are legal proceedings that they are concluded and any kind of process is exhausted. It's not that I have no opinions or no comment. It's that I'm bound by the rules of ethics to not provide public comment given the posture of the situation.
Sure. So last question. I think part of my issue with covering offices like the city attorney's office is that I'm not always sure how to engage with the office as a resident of Milwaukee, or if this is an office that the general public even can engage with, right? On that note, are there issues that your office would like public input on in the coming months or in the years ahead?
Yeah. So we, as a law firm, our client, who we represent, is often the entity of the city of Milwaukee or the department or a board or a commission. And so it's not that we have a legal obligation to every resident of the city. So we have occasionally individuals that come in seeking direct representation. They have a landlord-tenant dispute or they want legal advice on a given issue. We do not provide representation to individual residents of the city of Milwaukee. We are not a public interest law firm. Where I think some of the priorities we've outlined, where I hope to hear from residents is on these quality of life, neighborhood level issues where we can be impactful with proactive litigation on housing, on environmental remediation, on driving in safe streets. These are areas where we directly are involved, and it's important for us to know and hear from residents, but we may not be able to our client is not necessarily resident, A on the block. But we can certainly take that feedback and help work through those channels to understand how the city regulates that type of behavior and what role our law firm plays in that regulation.
Gotcha. So it's not something like you want residents to send you in, you know, tips about reckless driving or problem landlords or anything like that.
Those complaints are most appropriate and effectively routed through the police department or the neighborhood Department of Neighborhood Services or the common council member that represents the resident or the area. We work with them on a daily basis. How those complaints are generated for us and our involvement is routed through that government entity. The tip of the spear is the police department or the Department of Neighborhood Services, and we receive those referrals and then take action in court. I don't want to say that I would be ungrateful for that feedback, but if a resident heard this interview and emails me tomorrow saying they don't like they have a problem house on their block, I in all likelihood am not going to sue that owner because of what the resident called in. We have to go through those procedures, and that's necessary to take legal action because the requirements of the law to sustain a conviction, to win, ultimately, we need to follow the correct procedure.
Gotcha. Well, Evan, thank you again so much for joining me on Lake Effect. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Evan Goyke is Milwaukee's city attorney and the subject of a profile in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. He spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll tell you about this year's Milwaukee Muslim Film Festival. But first, we'll learn why leaves change colors in the fall. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Fall is here, and leaves across Wisconsin are starting to turn hues of orange, yellow, and red. But you might be wondering, why do some leaves change color in the fall? To get to the bottom of our fall colors, Lake Effect's Excret Nunez is joined by Erica Young, a professor of biological sciences at UWM. She explains changing leaves start with environmental cues, like days getting shorter and chillier.
I don't know about you, but fall is my favorite season, and that really has to do with the changing colors in the leaves. But before we get into why leaves change colors, can you help explain why leaves are green?
Yeah, I also love fall, although obviously the plants are doing their job over the whole of the summer, and they need that green chlorophyll pigment to help them do that. So this helps them harvest light energy, which they convert into chemical energy, which they can then store and ultimately produce sugars, which they can use as food, but also can be stored in the plant and be a food for other organisms that might eat that plant. So that chlorophyll is about harvesting solar energy and basically driving everything on this planet. So chlorophyll is pretty important.
Yeah, that's a big role. So what happens to chlorophyll in the fall when the sun isn't out as long as it is in the summer?
So the chlorophyll is in the leaves during the summer, and there are other pigments in there as well. But as the plants sense that the days are getting shorter and the temperature is going down, particularly at night when we get kind of little chills, which is part of what makes fall really a lovely time as well, the plants start getting ready for winter. So one of the adaptations to coping and surviving in the winter that we have here is to not have the delicate parts, the leaves, on the plant during the winter. So during fall, when they're getting those signals of the shortening days and the cooler nights, they start activating processes to get ready for winter. And chlorophyll is a pigment that has nitrogen in it, which is an important resource for plants. It's often limiting. And so instead of just losing that chlorophyll when the leaves fall off the tree, they withdraw that chlorophyll slowly from the leaves and store that nutrients in the rest of the plant and in the roots during winter so that they can use it again in spring. And this involves breaking down the chlorophyll molecules and translocating those nutrients out of the leaf back into the plant. So at that point, the leaves stop being quite so green, but we can see the other pigments that were always there over the summer, but were often masked by that bright, strong green color of the chlorophyll. And so we see other pigments like carotenoids, which are the yellows and oranges. And some plants also start making other pigments called anthocyanins, which they make during the fall to protect their leaves during that process while they're, you know, recovering nutrients. We call this fall senescence. And so these anthocyanins are more of the reds and purple colors that you can see in some of the plant species.
So in addition to chillier nights and shorter days, what other environmental conditions make leaves change color?
So then there's also things like drought or water deprivation. And remember, we had a very dry period in September. And this can stress the plants out a little bit. And in some cases, that can mean that they start that fall senescence process a little quicker or a little earlier. there are other environmental stresses like nutrient deficiency, which might mean that they can't hang on to their leaves as long. And then there could be things like pathogens, microbial pathogens or insect pests that might stress the plant on an individual plant-by-plant basis over the summer, which might cause them to start sooner in their fall senescence process because they're feeling that stress. So they're integrating a lot of these different factors, and this can vary both species to species, but also in a microhabitat, you know, one plant that's growing in one in your garden versus one that's growing down the street may be experiencing slightly different conditions, and this may influence how quickly they start fall senescence. But also there could be genetic differences. So different genotypes may have earlier senescence or may have brighter colors just because of the genetic makeup of that plant.
So I'm really now understanding what you mean when this is a really complicated process.
Yeah, so their plants are integrating all of these different factors that they're experiencing. So for example, on my way here, I was looking at some of the trees on the Oakleaf Trail, and you can see, you know, one tree that's sort of starting to become gold, and the one right next to it is still very green. And so they are probably experiencing and integrating things in slightly different ways. But also on the tips of the trees that are kind of closer to the sky, I guess, they may be experiencing slightly colder conditions overnight, whereas lower down in the canopy, there may be a little bit more buffering of that. And so around the tips of the trees, you might start to see the color changes earlier than right at the base of the tree because of that micro environment those leaves are experiencing.
Yeah, so now I'm getting that there aren't really ideal conditions to see all the trees at its peak color.
Well, having said that, I mean, a good cold snap, a period of several days in which there's really cool nights, you know, getting down below 45 degrees or so Fahrenheit, is going to really start to entrain the trees to all start to respond at the same time. So that's possibly what tends to happen further north in Wisconsin when you get a cold snap, and that will instigate that fall senescence process maybe a little bit in a more coordinated way than further south here around Milwaukee.
That makes sense. And so now I'm thinking about the red and the orange and the yellow leaves. What determines whether a leaf will be a certain color?
Right. So the chlorophyll pigment that we talked about before is green, but the other pigments that can be present in leaves that can help with light harvesting during the summer, they include a group of pigments called the carotenoids. And as the name sounds, carotenoids, they are the same pigments that makes carrots orange. So oranges and yellows. So we get those colors in things like maples and birches and tamaracks and the aspen, of course, and ginkgos. And so when you take away the chlorophyll, what is left is that beautiful gold color of the carotenoids. If we are thinking about the reds, like red oak, red maples, dogwoods, burning bush is a great one. That might be a combination of the carotenoids plus another type of pigment called anthocyanins, which have more of those red-colored pigments. And then the purples that we see in things like Norway maples, some of the dogwoods, some of the ash trees or sumacs, those have probably a greater load of those anthocyanin pigments, which are in the reds and purples. And so this isn't just one pigment, but it could be a range of different anthocyanin compounds or molecules, and some of them have slightly different chemistry, so this leads them to have slightly different range of colors that we see.
So kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier, about the different factors of when a tree's leaves start to change colors, is climate change playing a role in when or where leaves change colors during the fall?
Yeah, great question. So as I said, the plants are integrating different signals both from the day length, and that day length is obviously not changing. You know, 300, 3,000, 3 million years ago, the day length at this time of year was similar, but the temperature is changing. And so some plants are going to be a little bit more sensitive to temperature. Some are going to be much more strongly driven in their autumn senescence by day length. And so those that are a little bit more temperature sensitive may be waiting longer, so to speak, in fall before they start instigating that fall senescence and the color change that we see. It may actually mean that across a landscape, some trees will be driven by the day length, and so they'll start to change at the same time as they did last year or last decade, whereas some trees may be waiting longer. And so you may actually get a sort of a stretching out of the autumn senescence period that you see on a landscape level as different trees are integrating signals in slightly different ways. Already you can see around Milwaukee there are trees that are losing leaves, the trees are gold, or those red and purple colors, whereas many trees just look like they did in August. So you can see there that the variability. And I think as you go further north, that colder temperatures help to compress the time scale over which the trees are going to start autumn senescence, which is why we often tend to go further north to get the en masse beautiful fall color experience.
Right. And it seems that, like you mentioned earlier, September was a drier month. So it seems that longer summers or those longer summer temperatures could delay fall colors in Wisconsin.
Yes, absolutely. And the other thing that with climate change is not just climate change, but other environmental change factors that are associated with that are things like insect pests and pathogens. And climate change stress may make plants in general and trees more susceptible to those kinds of stresses. Mm. And that might also influence how quickly or when they start that fall senescence process.
So my takeaway from this conversation is that fall plant cycles are really complex.
Yes, plants are integrating lots of signals, lots of biotic and abiotic things from the environment, but things also from the living environment around them.
Well, Erica, thank you so much for speaking with me today and sharing the science behind fall leaves.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
When autumn leaves start to fall.
Erica Young is a professor of biological sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez. Now in its ninth year, the Milwaukee Muslim Film Festival celebrates the transformative power of storytelling through film by promoting understanding, empathy, and unity for all audiences. The films shown over the four-day festival celebrate the diversity of Islamic culture and the power of the human spirit. Organized by the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition, the film festival also marks the launch of the nonprofit's new name, the Muslim Women's Coalition. Janann Najib is the president and co-founder of the organization, and she joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
This year marks the ninth annual Milwaukee Muslim Film Festival, but before we preview some of the films you'll be showing, I want to talk about the recent rebranding effort your organization is going through in conjunction with the festival. Can you share a little more?
Sure. For 30 years now, we have been known as the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition. But our work has expanded far beyond Milwaukee throughout the state for a number of years now. And in fact, we really have work that we do outside the state itself. And we have a number of groups that have reached out to us about the possibility of opening chapters in other states. So that's still a little bit away. We have some work to do, but it was definitely time to go ahead and change our name. We're dropping the Milwaukee and becoming the Muslim Women's Coalition. Our logo has changed. We are redoing our website, and that will be launching soon. And as part of that, too, we have a PR campaign that's going to be taking place to kind of help with that rebranding as well.
Yeah, so that campaign is called Connecting Hearts and Strengthening Communities. What is the focus? I mean, in general, you, of course, advocate for religious tolerance and women's empowerment. But for this specific campaign following the festival, what are some of the things you really want to hone in on for the community here?
I think what we really wanted to focus on is not just tolerance, but celebrating the diversity of our community here and how important that is. And really just showcasing how that diversity is part of what makes all of us who we are. We're all part and parcel. We share so many things together. We live in a community, we work, we play together, we get along together. We just, we want people to realize that the Muslim community is part and parcel, regardless of what political entities would like to create divisions or create polarization. And so it's not really a campaign about educating about Muslims. It's a campaign more of saying, we're here. We are important. We're part of this community, and we're part of that wonderful diversity that makes Milwaukee what it is.
Absolutely. And of course, the power of simply being shown visually representation, it goes a long way to be able to show what you are hoping to showcase, the positive and vibrant images of diverse Muslim women and girls in our community.
Yeah, and what people don't realize is that we have such a richness within the community in terms of careers, in terms of ethnicities, in terms of races. And so with the PR campaign and the images that are going to be out there, they're not models. We're actually using people from the community to represent what we're trying to say.
Obviously, a lot to look forward to for the Muslim Women's Coalition and, of course, the Milwaukee Muslim Film Festival. So let's give listeners a little preview of what's to come for the festival. And let's begin with the opening night film called Pain and Peace.
Well, we have a wonderful lineup this year, and we're expecting a great turnout. Pain and Peace is really about a survivor of hate. He's an individual that originally was is from Bangladesh, and him and two of his co-workers were attacked by a white supremacist when they were in their store, and the other two were killed. And he's the lone survivor, although he has long-term effects as a result of that. But what is really interesting, it is a compelling story because it's really about healing. And when the perpetrator was put on death row and it was getting close to, you know, the idea that he would face capital punishment, potentially, the person that came to stop it was the victim himself. And so I think it's an amazing story. And what's interesting about the film is that this individual, his name is Rais Bhutan, and he is going to be our talkback speaker, by the way, for opening night. He went around the country to speak with individuals that have experienced hate and violence from groups that felt they didn't want them in the country. And what he found is that a lot of times these individuals really took their self-hate and were kind of putting it on others. And so he interviewed both the survivors of that hate, and he also interviewed the perpetrators of the hate. And it's a very compelling film.
Next up, we're going to highlight a film called The Night Won't End.
Right. And The Night Won't End, we felt, is an important film just simply because of what's been happening this past year. We've seen so much death and destruction in Gaza, in the West Bank, now in Lebanon. And this is really a film that records much of what is happening on the ground. And it talks about really our government's complicity in these atrocities, in this genocide. And we have Dr. Sahloul, who is the CEO of Med Global, which is a medical mission group that's going to be, that is working out of the United States, but he had been there in Gaza and had helped deal with a lot of the victims. He's going to be coming to talk about his personal experiences as well.
Well, and films such as these are so important not only to highlight what has happened, but is continuing to happen. And it shows that documentary films can be just as much reactive and not just looking back on, quote unquote, a past experience.
Right, absolutely. And I think what is really important about the Milwaukee Muslim Film Festival is the fact that we're bringing films and we're bringing stories that are not often heard. You know, so many people don't have an opportunity to hear a lot of these stories. And so that's why it's really important for us to have these.
And lastly, there are many more than just the ones we're going to talk about. But lastly, we'll bring up the film called Hajan.
Yeah, we have a lot of films. So some that are heavy and some that are light. And Hajan is really an interesting film about desert camel racing. And it's a drama. And we thought, you know, this is something that's unique. People know more about horse racing, but not a lot of people know about camel racing. I remember a visit to the Gulf when I actually got on a camel and nearly fell off and broke my husband's back in the process, you know, just as a camel was getting up. So I can't imagine camel racing. But when we were thinking also about having a talkback speaker, we thought, well, who are we going to get, you know, to do that? And we found a woman, a Caucasian American woman, you know, in Louisville, Kentucky, Isabel, who had gotten interested actually in camel racing during a visit to the Gulf. And she participated in a number of camel races. And she's the only known American woman to be involved with that. And in fact, she now owns a camel, which she keeps in the Gulf, in Dubai. And so she's going to come up from Louisville, Kentucky to talk about her experience as well. So I want to also mention that one of the unique aspects of the Muslim Film Festival is that for now going on 9 years, every single film has a talk back or a panel or some component, because we feel that that's really part of the experience, to have that dialogue, to have that discussion. And we find that the majority of the people really stay and participate.
Yeah, definitely important to not just see something new, but share in that experience beyond just sitting next to someone at the theater.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. So it's very exciting. And yeah, and we expect that maybe some of the films might even sell out. So we encourage people to go to MilwaukeeFilm.org and purchase their tickets in advance.
Well, Janann, I want to thank you so much for joining me today to share more about the upcoming festival and, of course, the rebrand into the Muslims Women Coalition.
Thank you so much, Audrey. Great to speak with you again.
Janann Najib is the president and co-founder of the Muslim Women's Coalition. The 9th annual Milwaukee Muslim Film Festival starts tomorrow and runs through the 20th at the Oriental Theater. You can find more information and a complete list of films at WUWM.com. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions all about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll meet a Milwaukeean who's been observing full moons from the lakefront for years. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. How often do you think about space and what's out there with the moon, the stars, and beyond? For Milwaukee's Ebony Javan, it's a regular occasion. She visits the lakefront every time there's a full moon, and she's been doing it for more than a decade. WUWM's Mayan Silver shares the story of their chance encounter during a September supermoon.
About a month ago, I decided to go for a walk on the lakefront. It was 7 p.m. and the moon was unusually low to the horizon. It looked magical, as if it was coming out of the lake. It was bright orange, luminous and shiny, and I felt this magnetic pull to get closer and closer. So I walked to a cul-de-sac next to the lake that encircles a flagpole. That's where I met Ebony Javon, who seemed to have all of the answers. So what kind of moon is this?
It's a harvest moon.
And what's that?
So basically it just symbolized like in the times, like previous times or like people before us, it just, when they see the harvest moon, they know it's time to gather, collect everything and prepare for like the coming season. So that's kind of what the harvest moon means. And then it's the full, obviously, like they consider a harvest moon a super moon because when it appears, it just appears to be extremely large, but it's kind of an illusion just from the horizon of the lake.
It was pleasantly warm outside. Lake Michigan waves were slowly lapping up against the shore. But the star of the show was definitely this supermoon, the Harvest Moon, named after the fall harvesting season.
I don't know if you ever saw Mortal Kombat. It kind of like remind you of that Mortal Kombat symbol, but imagine that like coming out of the lake. So it just like looked like it's dripping and glistening. And then you see like the moonlight, but the moonlight was actually red, which is an illusion because of the atmosphere. So you just imagine seeing like a super blood moon, because the moon you see now is rising higher. It's getting lighter and lighter. But when it initially came out, it was like blood red.
There was also just this feeling of calmness. Ebony says that's because of the moon.
The moon is a stabilizer. You got to realize, even though the earth is spinning and the moon revolves around the earth, without the moon, the earth will be unstable. So it's like by the gravitational pull of the moon literally, like if the moon had an earth, it would like literally just be like, imagine like drinking too much coffee and you just jittery. But the moon does is pulls that, it like it gives tension, so now it stabilizes everything. So it just make you feel good.
I love that. Ebony says her days are pretty stressful. She works in property management. That makes her cherish these monthly moon outings even more.
You can imagine dealing with 4,000 plus different personalities. It just becomes like sometimes you get to a point where you come home, you don't even want to talk. But being here just kind of allow you to just like, it's no way to describe it. Like you just kind of feel like you're just a part of, like everything that's going on, you're just in sync with it. Like the moon is separate, the lake, the waters, like you have earth, water, moon, like you almost have you just have everything you need and it's free. So why not utilize it?
A free show of nature.
Absolutely. That's why I said you work so hard to get all of these nice fancy things, but when you realize everything in life is really free. Like the essentials for what you need to survive, I shouldn't say that. Obviously you need money to provide shelter, but your essentials are free.
Even so, it's kind of unusual to visit the lakefront every month to witness the full moon. How did Ebony get so tuned in?
As far as tuning in, I just kind of keep up with it. Like I said, you know the moon, eventually you're gonna have a full moon every 28, 31 days, etc. But it's just like paying attention, being in tune. And then, like I said, sometimes you just gotta come down here, you know, kick your shoes off, no socks, no sandals, just plant your feet in the grass and get grounded and just rejuvenate. It's kind of like, imagine charging your phone.
She says she uses a phone app to keep track of the moon's cycles. And she has her eye on some gear to help with moon watching.
I just was telling somebody yesterday, next summer, that's gonna be my next gift to myself. I'm gonna invest in a nice telescope that I can attach my camera to and then just vibe out, just, you know, stare at the sky, get lost.
And it gives you perspective, right?
It makes you realize how small you are in a bigger scheme of things. Like you're not really even a grain of salt. Like whatever would be a grain of salt within a grain of salt. Like don't get caught up in everything, the things that you can't change. You gotta accept it and keep it moving because time not gonna stop for that.
Ebony gets to thinking about the space beyond the moon, beyond what we can see, what she calls universes within universes.
Even if your mind ponder on that for too long, you'll start to get a headache because it's beyond your understanding as a human being. it's just bigger than us. That's why I said you just gotta, you know, show love and chop it up like how we met, just strangers just vibing out, like it's just the vibe. Like it's just the vibe. Man.
I love it. It's just a vibe. If you want to vibe on this month's full moon, it's again a super moon. This one's called the Hunter's Moon, happening tomorrow, October 17th. This is your notice to head out to the great outdoors, look up, and unplug. It'll be blood orange, low to the horizon, and beautiful. For Lake Effect, I'm Ayan Silver.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance neath the cover of October skies. You
know, the leaves. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, you can download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. A nonprofit that donates books to prisons has been told they can no longer provide books to people incarcerated in Wisconsin prisons. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn why. That's tomorrow at noon on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Make love to you tonight. I can't wait till the morning has come. And I know.